Hi, friends. Welcome back to Out of Focus. I'm Shannon Stewart, and today you are going to meet Helen. She grew up in the Soviet Union, came to the U.S. as a child, and spent much of her life convinced that faith was for the uneducated. But God had other plans. Her journey from skepticism to belief is one of the most thought-provoking and hope-filled stories you'll hear. I can't wait for you to meet her. Can you take us back to your early years when you were a child growing up in the Soviet Union when you couldn't even talk about your faith?
So not to date myself, but I was born towards the very last stages of the Soviet Union. This is for those of you who are under 50. This is when the Communist Party basically was still in charge of the country that is now known as Russia. And there was no religion that was allowed in that country of any kind, not Christian, not Jewish, nothing. The only religion that you had was basically the state. You believed in the state, and that was it. There was no God. There was no public discussions of God. So I left the Soviet Union. My parents escaped from the Soviet Union in 1979 and landed in the United States of America in 1980, which was a remarkable time to land. But my biggest memory of my life in the Soviet Union, where I lived my first 8.5 years, so I do have a memory, is how dark everything was, the lack of freedom, the lack of hope, the lack of God that was in the atmosphere. There was no joy. When I was a kid, I thought that was normal. I thought that all adults always look like this. And again, this is not at all a knock against the Russian people. In private, the Russian people, you couldn't have a personal ambition. You couldn't have some kind of a purpose that you were striving for, a career, some kind of opportunity that is outside your home. The Russian people, as a result, however, are people who were at the time, and still it's in our culture now, very focused on family and friends and the joy of celebrating each other. There was always a lot of music in my house. We always had a lot of friends in my home. And
like Russian music in your house?
Russian, and my father, who was my first hero. My father was very talented piano player, and he picked up American music. So again, those of you who may not be aware what the Soviet Union was like, you could not listen officially, legally, to any Western forms of art. That includes no Elvis Presley, no Beatles. All of that had to be snuck in via the black market. But my dad would listen to it and would pick it up by ear on the piano. So publicly, you couldn't really play Western music. But privately in our home, my dad used to play all the stuff he would pick up from what was at the time traded on the black market, which is records of Elvis Presley, records of the Beatles, et cetera. I grew up in a phenomenal childhood as a kid who doesn't know. So you don't know what's going on. You only know your personal life, that your friends love you, your parents love you. But you also remember that the minute you leave the house, there's a kind of a gray overhang in the atmosphere that is very difficult to describe to Americans who tend to be a much more open, gregarious, happy-go-lucky, optimistic type of people as a culture. That's what happens when you're born into freedom. When you don't have freedom, you're swimming in an ocean of ultimately really kind of existential hopelessness, and you're not even realizing you're swimming in it. But where I was really blessed as a kid is my dad in particular, he was a capitalist, even when he was in the Soviet Union. And he was a Zionist also, even though he was in the Soviet Union. I grew up with a very steady education at home from my father about the virtues of the United States of America, which you could go to prison for saying that publicly in the Soviet Union. Privately, my dad would, when I was a kid, he would close the door, I remember, to our kitchen. And it was just me and him sitting at the kitchen table. My dad would teach me, let me tell you about the United States of America. And he would talk to me about all these old industrialists like John D. Rockefeller and Carnegie and J.P. Morgan. And then he would tell me everything they achieved. And you could be anything you wanted to be if you went to America. And he would tell me about Disneyland and Mickey and Minnie Mouse. And I was a kid, right? So I'm like, this has got to be the greatest place on earth. And he told me about Israel, too. He told me how Israel was founded and how all the work that it took to basically build Israel from the desert, where there was nothing there before, and how the Jewish people had built it into what it is today. And so I was kind of ready, set, go. I was very fortunate that I got a terrific at-home schooling from my dad, even though this was totally the opposite of what I was being taught in the actual Soviet Union schools, where you were being propagandized all the time about the virtue of the founders of the Communist Party, There were pictures all over our classrooms of Lenin and Karl Marx and Trotsky and all the people who we now know actually ended up murdering over 20 million plus people.
How did he learn all these things about America and the freedoms and Disney?
So my dad was a very influential kind of a guy. He's a very gregarious, open personality. My dad, because of his personality and in spite of the fact that he was a Jew, again, you never told anybody this, that you were a Jew in the Soviet Union. He was the director of what we would call today Walmart. So he was the director of the largest grocery store in all of Moscow. And if you know anything about the Soviet economy, right, you had scarcity all the time. So if you were the director of the largest grocery store, you had a lot of power because you had the ability to control grocery inventory. So because of his position, he had a lot of friends.
And access.
And he had access to the black market. And those friends connected him to all of the pro-Western resources. But frankly, there's a bigger reason. Again, if you know the Soviet Union back then, you had the official economy, and then you had the black market economy. You had the public life that people led, and then you had this dual life, this private life. The fact is, you can never, ever control millions of people in spite of the government's greatest efforts to try to suppress this Western culture and information seeping into beyond the walls of the Soviet Union. It did. My family was able to get their hands on what to Americans would be a joke, but like Jordache jeans, Sergio Valente jeans, what was a commodity in the United States, it was considered only the few people had access to it in the Soviet Union. So you couldn't control it. The United States of America, especially in the post-World War II era, was so powerful. Its culture was so intoxicating. And in spite of all of the controls that were put in place, all the propaganda that was coming out of Russian national state-controlled television, you can't control all the people. There's an old saying, you can control some of the people some of the time, but you cannot control all the people all the time. So my dad was very plugged in. He was a very cool guy. He had a lot of influence. He had a lot of friendships and he had a lot of relationships in the country. And as a result of that, we knew who Elvis Presley was. We knew who the Beatles were. He was able to get Western makeup for not only my mother, but for her girlfriends. He was able to get his hands on some of
the. So you can't buy makeup at the grocery stores?
You can, but it's not American, not Western European, you can't.
Okay.
So, and that's when you knew you were something, is if you could get your hands on some Western makeup, if women could get their hands on Western makeup, if women could get their hands on Jordache jeans, that was a big deal. So that's kind of the atmosphere in which you grow up. And again, definitely there is no mention of God. We don't talk about it. We certainly don't worship. Maybe there were people who were worshiping privately when I was growing up. I certainly was not aware of that. It was not a part of my upbringing. The presence of God was not officially part of my upbringing. Unofficially, right, as many Jews were back then, they were very aware of their ethnic background, and there was a loyalty to other Jewish people and to Israel. But that is not the same thing as a belief in the Messiah or a belief in God. So you have all of these different dynamics that were taking place. And then I remember what made my father, in spite of the fact that we were living pretty good, pretty well by Soviet standards back then, what made my father decide to pull the plug on his Russian life and to take, in my opinion, was a heroic, enormous risk, which many immigrants will relate to this story, especially those immigrants who are coming from communist and totalitarian countries. My father, at one point, he got one of his KGB buddies drunk in the back of a cab and asked him, "No, I've been in this director of Walmart, for lack of a better word. I've been in this director role in Moscow for quite some time now. And I've noticed that you, the government, remember, everybody in the Soviet Union worked for the government. You guys have stopped advancing and moving me forward. And I want to know why." And the KGB guy, given the fact that he was drunk on vodka, was able to be honest. And he said, "Boris, did you ever really think that we would let a Jew go any further?"
So they knew he was a Jew?
Yes. This is somebody he knew. So this is a personal friend in the KGB who knew that my father was a Jew. My father, who worked all his life to protect his family from anti-Semitism and discrimination of any kind, worked to create the relationships in the government in order to make sure his family was protected, the next day made the decision to get us out. Because it's not so much, he didn't really do it for him or even for my mother. He really did it for me. because he knew at that point that my options would be limited. And he didn't want me to ever be limited in my choices. He wanted me to have freedom. And like I said, he was such a huge patriot of the United States of America at that point that he knew we had to go. So the way that you played the game was the next day he applied. You have a high profile defector, basically. He applies to the Soviet government to leave the country. He has to say in the documents, I'm a Jew and I'm going to Israel. You could not say I'm going to the United States of America. You could not say I'm going to Canada, Australia, England, nothing, because they would not let you out. It was a game that the Soviet government played with its Jewish citizens. If as a Jew you want out, you have to say, oh, it's because you want to go home to your motherland, Israel. If he had said, I'm going to America, he probably would have been in prison. So again, because of the incredible loyalty of some of his friends in the government, my father was able to get us out and get us approved for departure within 9 months of his application, which is, if anybody's read the stories of what are now called the Russian refuseniks, this is unheard of. It is unheard of. The Soviet government loved to play games with those people and to torture them if you attempted to leave the Soviet Union. Because remember, Soviet Union is supposed to be a paradise, right? A communist paradise. If you're leaving, it's an admission that you're going somewhere else for that paradise. Soviet government could not have afforded that. It literally tortured anybody who decided to leave. And what I mean by that is, and this happened to us too, my father immediately lost his job. My mother immediately lost her job. My parents pulled me out of school so that I would not be discriminated against as the daughter of people who are basically now in exile. And we became refuseniks.
So everyone started hearing about this.
We lost all of our friends with the exception of two.
Wow.
So he was Mr. Popular. We were the life of the party. All those parties that took place in my home where my daddy used to play the piano and all that was done. We lost our standing in the community. Our friends left us mainly because they were terrified to be associated with somebody who was formally applying to leave the Soviet Union. So they needed to protect themselves. My father never blamed them. I remember we kept a couple of friends who stood by us publicly. They would not abandon us because they themselves in pretty good positions of power and they felt safe. It was a huge risk. And that's kind of how I got out. 2.5 months. So it took us, we were waiting for the Soviet government to say, yes, you can go for about 8 to 9 months. And then once we left, it took us another 2.5 months to fly through Europe. That's the way the process worked at the time. As soon as we left the Soviet Union, we landed in Austria. And this is the first time we were in the middle of a Western society. And I'll never forget this. We weren't exactly starving Russians, right? My father was well-positioned when I was there, when I was in the Soviet Union. So here we are, we land in Austria, and we go to a grocery store for the first time, a Western grocery store. I still remember to this day, what now we Americans take for granted at Harris Teeter.
Oh, we take lots of things for granted.
There were wall-to-wall groceries at this grocery store in Austria, in Vienna, Austria. There were like 10 yogurt options. There were like 4 sour cream options. You can buy all kinds of bread. And this was so mind-blowing to us.
Give us a comparison. What was the grocery store like in the Soviet Union?
So if you went to the grocery store, which again, remember, given who I was, the shelves were empty most of the time, period, end of story. So scarcity was the key characteristic of the Soviet economy, right? Because you don't have capitalism, you don't have the supply and demand structure, you don't have the incentive for production because the government owns everything. There, it's a whole, we can go into economics, but scarcity was one of the defining features of the Soviet Union. And so people were constantly fighting. And when I say groceries, I'm talking about chicken. I'm talking about milk. I'm talking about the famous, you heard about the Soviet Union, you know, the famous long lines. You stood for 2 hours to get toilet paper. I'm talking about basic stuff. And you certainly didn't have, quote, oh, would you like this type of yogurt or this yogurt or this yogurt? None of that existed. So I remember we were so shocked that the first time that we went there, Shannon, we could have bought anything. Do you know what we bought for dinner? This was our dinner. I kid you not. And plus we didn't have much money. We bought bread and margarine. And we sat in our hotel room in Vienna, Austria, eating margarine and bread and thinking this was the greatest tasting thing we had ever tasted in our lives. I'll never forget it.
I believe it.
We never tasted bread like this.
And you're tasting freedom, being out, being and free.
Yes. That didn't even hit, honestly, till we landed in the U.S., but definitely the prosperity hit right away. We were like, wait, there's choices here? You can choose among three different breads? What does that, what? And I felt amazing. I never had bread like this. See, just small things, like the way bread tastes in the West is different from the way it tastes in a totalitarian economy. It's different.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, then we go through Rome. And in Rome, that we had to, that's ours, another point of paper processing before we finally landed in the United States. What was special about Rome, other than the fact that it was Rome? And again, if anybody here has not been to Italy as a Christian, Christianity is all over Italy. It is all over Rome. It's all over Venice. It's all over Florence. The presence of God is very much felt there. What an incredible story, right, of a bunch of guys in sandals defeating the greatest military empire in history. You can feel God's presence in Rome. I was too young to understand any of it. I remember my parents took me to St. Peter's Cathedral, and that was the first time I ever saw Jesus, a figurine of Jesus hanging on a cross. Because I had no background, no context, I was, to me, you were a kid, you're 8 and a half. You're like, I remember I'm thinking, what the heck is this guy? Who the heck is he? Why is this guy on a cross? And I remember nobody had any answers for me. I never even heard of the Jesus story, and I was 8 and a half years old. I knew a lot about Lenin and Marx, but I couldn't tell you who Jesus Christ was. But what I remember there when we landed in Italy was the first thing my parents did was they bought me a silver Star of David, and they put it around my neck and they said, now you can wear it. So that was the first ever opportunity and time in my life where I could publicly wear a religious symbol. So that was a big deal. That was the first religious symbol I would ever wear, was the Star of David as a Jew. And that's how we arrived. And then we arrived in the United States and we got to work. My parents, and again, not to get political, but it was very different back then, the immigrants, at least the immigrants we came with. The immigrants that came with us to the United States in particular, obviously the others went somewhere else. We went to America. Were patriots. They immediately got to learning the English language. There was no question of a second language. What are you talking about? Like, we're Americans now. They were so proud that they were Americans. They immediately started learning the Constitution and American history, because if you recall, you had to pass an exam after being in America for 3 to 5 years to become a citizen. So they started to study for that exam right away. They went to English school right away to learn the English language. These are, again, my dad is at 40 at this point. My mom is 37. So it's not like they're spring chickens. And here they were going to
school.
What
are you saying, Helen? I'm 41. I'm kidding.
You ain't no spring chicken. But you know what I mean? Imagine, yeah, though, coming to a totally different country with a language you do not speak and a culture you know nothing about other than what you read in books in silence and secret.
From what you said about your dad being in the Soviet Union and how he studied and learned about America, yes, and even Disney World, you could tell that he had a heart for our country.
He
and
did.
He was a patriot from afar at that point.
He was. He always was. He loved American culture. He truly loved it with all his heart. It means he loved it with his mind. He understood the founding principles. He understood why they ultimately created the culture that we had here in this country.
Did he cry when he landed here?
I don't know if he cried, but okay. My dad, he's a very passionate man.
I could see him just, we made it.
Oh, yeah. He was so proud to be an American. To that point of how proud they were, my name, Helen, my American name, is actually not a direct translation from my Russian name. They named me after their English teacher, their first teacher of the English language in the United States.
Wow.
And so I'm actually named after their teacher, Helen. Like I said, that's not my Russian name. And that's who I'm named after, to give you an example of how much they valued this culture. We were poor. We were very poor, like many immigrants who come here. That was probably the most difficult assimilation for me and for my mother. My dad was always stronger, but I think my mom took it hard and I took it hard. Still no God at this point in our lives. We only had each other.
So you land in New York. Where do you guys go next?
Philadelphia. We moved to Philly only because the only people we knew in America happened to have landed in Philly. So we quickly took the Greyhound, or I remember how we got there, but we got to Philly like within 48 hours of landing in JFK. And that's where I grew up. That's where I learned the English. That's where I still have many of my friends who might be listening to this podcast who may not even know I'm a Christian. Be like, what? You're a Christian now? But I still have friends. Some of my closest friends are still there, or are coming from there. But it was tough. It's tough to assimilate. It was tough for me as a kid. And it was at a time when during the Cold War. And as you can imagine, there was the American kids in general are hard, are tough. But American kids were not very welcoming. I had a very heavy Russian accent in English at that time. And
I'm American and I was bullied for not doing what everyone else was doing.
Exactly.
What did you do this weekend? Hang out with your mom? And I did. I said, yeah, actually I did. And we had a great time. So yeah. I do know how kids can be.
Kids are rough. And anyway, there was actually some stupid anti-Semitic comments also made by some American kids. Stupid stuff that kids say. Like, I think one of the young kids, what's interesting is that I remember this comment, something like, you people killed Jesus or just like that. And again, and I have no idea who Jesus even is. I didn't take it personally because I had no idea what he was talking about. So that's how we landed in the United States. It was tough. Like I said, we were poor. My dad, I remember when we first got here, I'm going to make a controversial statement. When we first got here, I've noticed that many of the Russian Jewish immigrants who came with us began to get on government programs, not Medicare, but food stamps, things that were there for people who are poor and need help. And I remember saying to my dad, and we struggled, and my dad refused to take any government assistance. And I was like, Daddy, what about this person's mom and and that person's mom? They're taking government assistance as immigrants. Why can't we take it? I'll never forget. My dad turned to me and he said, darling, we didn't come here to live off the American taxpayers. I never forgot that. I was 9. I never forgot it.
Wow.
Because he felt we were able-bodied and that we should be able to make it in America on our own without government assistance. That was a big thing for him. He was a very proud man. We will not live off the American people. Maybe it had to do with where we came from, living off the government. He said, we're not going to live off the government, which to him was the American people. So that streak of independence and self-reliance, he built in from a very young age. And
what did he end up finding to do for work?
Well, he became a businessman and he had several successful restaurants and ultimately ended up having a successful real estate brokerage, which is why he left Mr. Donald Trump.
Wow. Yes. I mean, we know somebody that did the same thing. They came over here with $50. And yes. They had a few restaurants. The ambition, the drive, the passion, knowing that you're free.
And knowing because you have something to compare it to. I always joke with my younger friends, say, you guys all need to travel the world. Again, and all this, my family was never anti-God, but God didn't play any active role. And what's important, I did go to a great school. Again, ambition, worked hard, got into a great college.
You went to Ivy League school.
Ivy League. And of course, my parents were super proud. Like, you know, all immigrants are. This is like what they're here for. They give their kids what they couldn't have. And on that Ivy League school, undergrad, you saw the beginnings of what it was nowhere near what you see today. Today, what we're seeing on the news go on college campuses, I won't get political, but we know what it is. It's horrible. But certainly, I would say 99%, definitely of the college professors were leaning towards socialism and communism. And this is in the number one business school in the country, by the way, the number one.
When you were there?
Yes, when I was there. And there was a lot of people just leaning towards hard left. There was no God. Again, we don't do God. The general, I take more of this responsibility. I'm a kid. But the ocean that I swam in the Ivy League University was a far left secular environment, right? Any religious studies is almost considered an oxymoron. You are either a man of education or you are a man of faith. And those two do not go together is kind of the mess without anybody ever saying it, that's kind of how I felt by the time I graduated college. To me, in my mind, faith and superstition were the same. Reason and faith were opposites. And I was a person of reason. I came from a secular background. We were very aware that we were Jewish, but that's where it ended. There was really no relationship with God. Yes, we would probably go to some high holy holidays like many Jewish people in America do today. Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Hanukkah, Passover. And we passed along these great stories of the Jewish people. Passover, again, what the Jews went through to build Israel and all of this stuff. But again, no relationship with God. God was just maybe something somewhere we don't know.
Were you like too smart for
when
you thought
I graduated,
you knew it all or
yes,
you had it all
yes,
together
yes,
and you didn't
and
need
young,
God?
You're young, right? You're young. So why I share this piece is this, I think you will find not uncommon among youth that is graduating from college. As the great Dennis Prager likes to always say, there's a lot of knowledge in college, but not a whole lot of wisdom. And you graduate with a lot of knowledge, but no wisdom. You add to that youth, which means you don't have the life experience to know that you're not in charge. You don't have the life experience to know you really are not really in control of pretty much most things in this world. You come out thinking that you are going to solve all the world's problems because, dang it, you are smart enough and you're certainly idealistic enough and you're ideological enough and you're going to change the world. And God, who's that? Never heard of him. What I do remember strongly is I came out with a very strong bias against the Christian people, which is very interesting. And not just them, pretty much any religious people. I honestly wasn't really friendly to religious Jews either, but definitely the Christian people, which is interesting because nobody ever explicitly messaged anything like that to me in college. But yet I came out thinking, these people are crazy. They think some guy came back from the dead. You clearly cannot be intelligent and religious at the same time. That I do remember, having a very strong anti-religious bias out of college.
What happened after college? Did people ask you to church? I remember you saying you started to read books about the afterlife. Was that next?
That was, no. So I probably spent, realistically, the next 20 years were pretty much years of agnosticism for me. So I would say between 20 to 40 for sure. There were several things, but for the most part, God was not in my life.
Was your number one a career?
Yes. Yes. My purpose. And my purpose was never in any way, did I ever even ask questions like, what does God want? Is my purpose aligned with what he would like to see me do? Things that my Christian friends and teachers taught me later about humility and saying, not my will, but yours. That would have been unheard of to me.
Even, it was more about self, which it's, a lot absolutely. Of people can relate to. I've had self on the throne of my heart before as well.
Yes,
it was
you're your own greatest idol.
Yes, yes, I want what I want, even though it's going to destroy me.
But you know what, though? We're, like I said, I do think youth, the more I think about it, I mean, I watch the kids today, right? And I'm like, wow, like just... they're just young. We do have a lot of great youth coming up today.
No, I'm so encouraged when I hear some stories. I feel like there's at least a divide. You can see a shift where there is revival and people are, especially Gen Z, are giving their life to Jesus. They're getting baptized. Yep. They're being bold in their faith and unashamed of the gospel. And it's so beautiful. And there's some other ones on college campuses that are taking a different route.
Thank you to the late, great Charlie Kirk for paving the way. I have so much respect for him. He was truly a unique human being. I don't think there would be this revival going on today. It wasn't just because of what he said, which he said brilliantly, which he studied for very hard.
He was smart.
It was who he was. It was how he said it. It was the way he loved you when he disagreed with you is what moved people. So he is truly a special human being. And I know that he's got with God right now. And I told my husband, I said, baby, because my husband's like, this is a horrible tragedy. But I said, it is, baby. But I just have a very strong feeling that this was always supposed to happen. The way that he was taken out, the age at which he was taken out, but also the fact that I don't think he felt any pain. It was within seconds. It was almost like he was here 1 second and then he was with God the next. He's probably like, what happened?
Yeah. Know?
So I feel it's just too big of an event to have just... who could have seen that coming? No, I think and the ramifications and all the waves of his death, I think that I'm not sure if this was not something that was not ordained.
Well, God definitely allowed it. He didn't stop it. We all have a free will and he can turn something that's wicked and evil and somehow turn it for good. His beauty for ashes. And I just love that about him.
He will always turn it to his good. Mm-hmm. He will always, and how horrible we could be suffering greatly here, but he will always.
Or even the things that I've done, somehow he can rewrite my story and redeem chapters and he can turn beauty from the mess.
100% of the time.
Only Jesus. Only God can do that.
Can pull that off. So real quick, what started to happen, right, is, and again, you know how Steve Jobs always used to say, you can only connect the dots backward. So even though I was living the life as a very happy agnostic, I can get a lot of cool stuff from this world, but you cannot have what Christ gives you.
No, you cannot.
Anywhere else. And I'm learning that every single day.
And even happiness is temporary. It's an emotion and it can constantly change.
Yes. So what has started to happen is so there were several things that were going on. I got older. First of all, I lost my mother when I was 20. Looking back on it, I actually don't have a whole lot of memory of my 20s because if you've ever lost a beloved parent, and unexpectedly, you're not supposed to lose your parent at 20. And my mother was the center of my universe. Your universe blows up, basically. It's like having a child who's you live on a planet and your planet just blew up. So she was taken away and spent the next 10 years, really the wonder, I call it the wonder years, W-A-N-D-E-R, wandering. So I don't remember much Christian or any form of religious faith-based influences coming into my life at that time. Yet it's funny, then you look back, you go, it was always there. By the way, when I was a kid, I think I believed in God. I just didn't have a name for it or a context or historical understanding. You have to be an educated person to lose faith. This is what so Tennis Prager always said. You have to go to college to think God doesn't exist. Anyways, so it was like it was educated out of you by all the wrong teachers. And then eventually, I met my husband when I was 30. My husband, who is just the love of my life.
Love him.
Oh, thank you. He loves you guys. It took your husband to bring my husband back into the church because my husband was so hurt by the church. He spent 20, 30 years without ever entering a church building until he met Mike Lee. And now he's there every Sunday to hear Mike teach. So loves him. He just loves Mike so much. I met my husband when I was 30 in California. I had moved to California at that point. And my husband, he's just one of the most incredible people that I know. My husband's heart, in my opinion, he's very close to Christ. Now, here's what else is interesting. I never dated Jewish guys. My husband was the first Jewish guy I dated, and he's the one I married. And I marry a Jewish guy, and it turns out this Jewish guy is a Christian.
He was a Christian when you married him, but you weren't a Christian?
Right.
Wow.
That's right. And I remember him telling me, and this is my husband. I will let my husband tell the story, but my husband, this is where the joke comes from. I always joke about why he loves gospel, why he loves gospel music so much, is because he accepted Christ during a gospel worship session. My husband, Jewish kid, very Jewish kid, means went to Hebrew school, unlike me, right? Because he was an American, right? So he could publicly be a Jew in a way I couldn't as a kid. He went to Hebrew school. He had a bar mitzvah. It was a very public bar mitzvah, the typical Jewish bar mitzvah, tons of people, tons of money. He actually spoke Hebrew, which he doesn't anymore, I think, but he always celebrated Hanukkah, all of that stuff, right? Totally Jewish kid. But he was a kid in trouble. And to make a long story short, he got himself so much in trouble that by the time he was in front of a judge in a courtroom, and this is, I think he's 16, 15 at this point, for the fourth time, he's in front of a court and he's been his cocky self because he's evaded jail time all the other three times. This judge said, I'm done with you now. I'm done with you. And throws him into the juvie in LA, in LA County. In there, and he almost gets himself killed while he's in there. And so now this is all happening. I'm still a kid in Russia somewhere, I think, right? Or no, I maybe just landed
Philadelphia,
in America.
Maybe.
Yeah. Meanwhile, my husband's 7 years older than I am. And there he is, this Jewish white kid in jail and totally alone. Like I said, almost gets killed because there were gangs there, the whole thing. And lo and behold, guess who came around once a week to his jail, to his juvenile facility? Christian missionaries. And one of those people, I still remember his name. My husband told me his name was an elderly Christian man whose name was Klein DeBoe. And my husband told me the story of when Klein would arrive, and sometimes they would have cookies or whatever. It's a Christian ministry, whatever they brought to the young juvenile delinquents that my husband was. He said the minute Klein would walk in, he knew he was different. There was something about the way, the energy that came out of Klein. And he said, Klein had come up to him for the first time and said, hi, my name is Klein DeBoe, and I'm here to minister to you, and I'm happy to listen to you and share God's word. And my husband's like most of us Jews, you know, Jewish, but not religious, right? My husband immediately goes, oh, no, no, no. My husband says to him, I'm a Jew. And Klein just calmly goes, well, that's okay. That doesn't matter. He just... So
I can still read you the Bible.
I'm going to go ahead and we're just going to proceed then. Right? And Jeff, but again, because, and this is a repeat thesis, right? How we appear as Christians. If Klein had appeared thumping his Bible or being judgmental, but because he had so much love to give, my husband just melted. And my husband's a strong man. It's not somebody you just melt. But this man, was something about this man, that Holy Spirit was so strong in him. And Klein began to read God's word, and Jeff would listen. Okay, and every Sunday, Klein would come back, and he would do more of God's word, and they would talk, and he would do more of God's word. Okay, while this is happening, Jeff, being my husband, who he was, figured out the only way he will ever get out of this jail cell during a week is if he went to a little prayer, what's it called, like a little... What is it called?
A chapel?
Chapel, thank you. There was a chapel in this juvenile prison or jail, whatever you want to call it. And that's the only way you were getting out. And so my husband, being a smart Jew, went, yeah, I'll go.
I'm smiling because I can see him doing
this. Go. I'll go. I need out of the room. But remember, Klein's been
reading the Bible,
working on him already now for I don't know how many weeks now. And at the same time, so he gets this opportunity to leave his jail cell to go to this chapel. And he goes. This is already after spending some time with Klein. My understanding is quite a bit of time with Klein. He goes. And there's a pastor and there's an incredible black gospel choir. I don't know how big the choir was in this chapel, but there they were. And they rocked that building, Jeff said. And then the pastor turns to all those juvenile delinquents who did attend and said, if you would like to ask for our Lord Jesus Christ to now come into your life, just ask for him and he will be there. And Jeff did, because the music already had broken him down, right? And Jeff, and then Klein has been talking to him. And Jeff's like, I have nothing to lose. My life sucks. I'm going to ask for the Lord. And he does. And he was 16 years old. And he said, I'll have to tell physically what occurred to him. But if he tells the story, he talks about what many people report, right? The feeling of worth starting at the top of his head and then going all the way down. And this proud Jewish kid starts crying in the middle of this chapel. And he's been a Christian now ever since, and he's 62. And he, through all of life's tribulations, he has adored Christ. And even though, and I'll let him tell the story, he left the church in his 20s, I think, or early 30s, because death by church, there was some of the corruption that went on there. He left the church he was going to. He never left Jesus Christ. And he loves him. But at that time, so when I met him, he was not an overtly, remember, he was away from a church building. He didn't go to church.
That
remember, he was
yes.
already away from the church.
Yes.
And he knew that I was not religious. And worse, I was kind of hostile to the very idea of God and Jesus Christ. Forget it. He let me be, and I remember this, he never tried to like, he never wasn't worried about are we equally yoked, or he wasn't like trying to push me toward God. He just loved me. But the way he loved, I always said, Jeff, the way you love, it's like him. And Jeff always says to me, Helen, that's because I live my life every day as if I always ask myself, if Christ is standing next to me right now, would I behave like this? And he says, I live every day with the assumption that he can see me. He's standing next to me.
Well, he can see us.
Yes,
his eyes are looking to and fro.
Yes.
He can see what's in our hearts and what
but
we think.
But he let me go on my journey, and he put up with all of my atheism. And I would say I was more an agnostic, sometimes drifting towards downright atheism. But we were married at least 15 years at this point, believe it or not. And God began, and I'm thinking back, some of the even moves my husband made. You know, my husband was the one who reunited me with my dad, because my dad and I were estranged for 10 years after I lost my mother. It was the first thing my husband did was say, you need to go back to your father. You need to reconcile with your dad. He's your dad. When I would say, oh, he's this, he's that, and he was mean to me after mom died, and I don't want to ever talk to him. He was like, my husband was like, unacceptable. He's your father. You go back. And we reconciled. And if it wasn't for my husband, I wouldn't have had the 25 years then that I got before my father passed away ultimately. Anyway, so now we're in California. We've been married for about 15 years, and God begins to pursue me, I think, more aggressively. I start to be surrounded. It's just maybe where we lived. We lived in California, of all places.
Had an awesome Christian connection in California.
There
I actually
go.
Stayed on a lady's couch
yes.
that was involved with Models for Christ. So there are Christians scattered everywhere. They were angels to me in California.
And the California Christians are very powerful. But one of my best friends, it turned out, a woman who would become one of my best friends was a deep Christian. One of my men, who is now one of my mentors, was an incredible Christian. And things begin to happen. So I began to notice, now I'm in my late 30s, and I begin to notice that some of our California friends happen to have certain things in common that I couldn't put my finger on. I noticed that they were very strong, and I mean existentially strong. That trouble and tragedy, when it hit them, the way they lived it was different from some of my other friends. I noticed that they were the most giving, bloody people that I ever knew. They would show, literally, one Christian friend showed up on my doorstep to give me money when they knew I was in trouble. Like, how did you know? I didn't even ask you to be here. He said, God told me I needed to be here today. And I was like, stop. That's ridiculous, right? Again, I was not a believer. God began to put people in my life that were incredible. And I began to notice a pattern that some of my friends were able to bear tragedy and bear hardship differently than others. I began to notice that certain of my friends would show up at my door, true story, knock on my door and literally say, I have some money for you because God told me that you needed this money. And of course, they were right. But I was like, stop it, you guys. Come on. But I began to notice that literally some of the most impactful people in my life all had one thing in common. They all were believers. I was just like swimming in this ocean of these great Christian friends who, none of whom, again, this goes back to how, what kind of a witness you are to the faith. None of them were Bible thumpers. None of them were like, you need to believe this. And if you don't, you're going to go to hell. Totally not this way. Maybe because they were in California. And so they knew how to be on the down low. I don't know. But it was the way that they, in which they lived their life.
If you were to switch it around and let's say you're Muslim or something and they're like shoving it down your throat, you're not going to want to believe. You're not going to want to listen.
Yes.
So your life actually preaches more than your words.
Yes.
You don't have to tell someone you're honest. Let them see it. Or generous. They can see it.
Yes.
You bear fruit.
Yes.
And you want them to see the fruit.
And around this time, again, one of those people who I'm friends with to this day, I consider him a mentor. He's actually currently the dean of Trinity Law School, which is the only Christian law school in California. Really an incredible man. And I'll never forget it. My husband was starting his business and was looking for sources of capital and money. And of course, guess whose money funded our business in the beginning when my husband was getting started? Eric's money. And I'll never forget it. He shows up very calmly with a checkbook and just sits on our couch at the time in California. And he just calmly writes a big check. And my husband's stunned. And he just calmly goes, he's like, what's for dinner? Totally humble. Nothing performative. You know how some people make it a bit.
Yes, Mike's told me some stories. Yes. They want you to see.
The story that Mike taught.
Yes.
Right? Mike taught us this, right? Performative faith.
Yes.
This is something like.
Don't let your right hand know what your left hand is doing. You do it in secret. You're doing it unto the Lord. You're not doing it for a show.
And that's how he wrote it. And then afterwards, it took my husband. He refused to accept interest. My husband was like, you would be making interest if this money was at a bank. Why won't you let us pay you interest on this loan? And the guy's like, no. So we did it anyway. So we just stopped fighting. He's just fighting. You know, we're still like not quite there. He's deeper in his faith, right? But this is an example of what I mean. At the end of the day, it was Christian Money who funded my husband's business, which became ultimately a big success in California and now is successful here in North Carolina. But it was Christian Money who funded us. And I began to get older and then life stepped in.
I want to hear about how you were invited to the pastor's house.
Coming.
I love
that. So around the same time, I had lost my father. My father died of cancer very quickly within a year of diagnosis. And of course, I was devastated. I was thrilled that I got the time that I had with him, but he was my last great hero. My husband's taken that place now, but I was pretty devastated. And I remember when he died, some of my friends began to send me. This is when they began to send near-death experience. They knew I was not a religious person. They could not approach me through the faith angle. So they're like, how do we give her comfort without throwing the word Christ at her or throwing the word God at her? And this is what I love about my friends is they put me first. And just like for other people who found Christ later in life, God sometimes takes himself out of the picture so that he can reach you in another way. And here were my friends, some of whom were not Christians either. They sent me near-death experience stuff because what is near-death experience is these are simply testimonies of other people. But if you read them, you'll see many of those people lived. There's definitely a life after here. There's definitely another world after this. But many of them absolutely encounter a being or God, or many of them encounter their angels, whatever. At that point, I began to realize there may be something else going on other that we do not see, something bigger than the world here. Again, nothing religious, no Jesus Christ, nothing. But I began to kind of read and do my own research and read these testimonies of what people went through. People who lived, people who died and came back, and frankly, some people who lived. And some people are fortunate to encounter God in a very explicit way without ever dying. Some of their stories and all of that got me kind of also helped. So again, the loss of a loved one, turning to the science of life and death began to open my mind a little bit to it. While at the same time, then here come some of my Christian, you know, living with Christian people who were such phenomenal witnesses to the life of Christ without ever seeing his name once. They simply lived it. So around this time, here we are living in this Christian community. I'm reading these near-death experience books. I'm going to work. I'm living my life, grieving my dad, but I'm ready kind of moving on. One of my closest friends, somebody who's still one of my best friends today, says, listen, so she decides to move in now. She thinks, okay, I'm going to make my move. She says, you know what? My pastor, my church, you know, Helen, you love personal development, right? I know you do. You love Tony Robbins. You love all of this. My pastor, he's going to start teaching a personal development series at his house. Why don't you come? And I'm like, April, is this a trick, right? You trying to get me to come over to your pastor's house so he could try to get me to be a Christian or to believe in Christ? But she said, no, oh no. She's like, totally, no, 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 no. This is, I'm telling you, Helen, this is not at all Christian based. It's just a bunch of people sitting around. He's a great psychologist. He's going to do a personal development class for all of us. I'm going to be there. You need to go. So then she goes in cahoots with my husband and my husband gets on board. And so between her and my husband, they get me to go one night. So I go. And again, God moved. Guess what? Turns out this pastor, this whole time, the man who brought me ultimately to Christ, was literally living three doors down from my house. Her pastor lived three doors down from me. I never knew it. The pastor of Lighthouse Church of California was in my block. This guy who's changed so many lives in his 40-year tenure as a pastor. Never knew it. What are the chances? She's like, come on, you just walk over to his, he's right there, right? So I had no excuses. I didn't have to get into my car even. Okay. I was like, fine. So between my husband and April, I go. And I go and we show up at his house. And of course, everybody's very nice. Lo and behold, there are about maybe 20, 30 other people there. We all sit in a circle and he's like, he's here in the circle and the circle's kind of around him. And he starts calling and he goes literally person by person so that people could share a little bit about their backgrounds, where they're from. And he would comment a little bit and then he would move on to the next person. And then he comes to me. So I'm here and I remember my husband is here and my friend April's, my husband's to the left of me immediately and my friend April's to the left of him and they're just looking at me. Remember, April, Christian, my husband's a Jewish Christian, right? And I'm the atheist agnostic sitting here.
Were they worried about what you might say?
Yes, okay. They thought, they knew me. They knew my, again, very cocky at this point, arrogant, right? Opening my mind a little bit to this near-death stuff. But still, they know my personality. Like, don't mess with my arguments. I'm ready. So I'm ready to take on this pastor. I'm very well educated. Of course, later I found out this guy's like 10 times got a PhD at this point, right? But I don't know all this. To me, again, pastor, how smart can he be? He probably just knows the Bible. They're looking at me like, don't be disrespectful to him. Because they really, especially April, really loved him. And I remember Gary looks at me and goes, and who are you? And I introduce myself briefly. And I say, and I'm this and this and I popped off and said something stupid like, you know, yes, and I'm an agnostic and I believe in God, but not Jesus or something like that. And I said it with my usual attitude, cocky, arrogant attitude. I remember Pastor Gary looking at me, holding my eyes for like 15 seconds, just thinking, looks at me and then he goes, stick with what you know and moves on. And I was like, looking at him like, wait a minute, aren't you going to like argue? Aren't you going to try to convince me that Christ is real and that I should believe in him? And he just didn't. He's just okay. Because I told him I'm a Jew who doesn't believe in Jesus. And he goes, okay, peace out. And he just went on to my husband, went on to Abel and started talking. And I'm listening the way he's talking to people. And again, he's really not, this is not a religious class. This is a kind of a development class, self-betterment class. And I watch him and I realize this is an impressive guy. He knows people. He understands people. He listens and he seems to be really smart, which again, to me, smart matters.
Appealing to you.
It's appealing. Yeah, if you're going to try to convince me of anything, I got to think you're, quote, smart. Back then, smart was really important to me. It was more important than so many other things that are actually much more important than being smart. So we were done with the whole personal development session that we had as a group. And then after that, I came up to my pastor, the man who became my pastor. At the time wasn't. I came up to Pastor Gary, who led this personal development session, and people were dispersing. And I just came up to him and I said, well, thank you so much for having me, Pastor Gary, in the house. And I remember he said, no problem. Yeah, great. Good to see you. It's nice to meet you again. Never once mentioned Jesus. Never once said Christ. Never once tried in any way to proselytize. But again, it's who he was that was so compelling. In fact, I can literally go back and count on my hand who the Christian people were who were around me that were so compelling by, just like Klein DeBoer was for my husband, by not only the lives that they led, but their presence. And Gary was one of them. There was just something about him. He was very compelling. The man had love coming out of every pore in his body. The way he looked at you, I don't embarrass him by saying it was Christ-like, but basically you can see that. There's a love for a human being that is standing in front of him. That's what drew me to him and his church. Even though he played it all off like, oh, nice to have you here, Helen. And then said, well, I'm thinking I may go to your church this Sunday. And no matter what he really felt at the time, he was like, okay, well, you do that. We'd love to have you. Like, very like, no big deal. And I go to April, who's still there with me in the house, who walked me to the guy who became a pastor, Pastor Gary's house. And I tell her, I said, April, I think I may go this Sunday to your church. And April, she's like, you will? I said, yes. She goes, great. That was it. I remember we slam out of there as if she got out of my face pretty quickly. Like we quickly walked home, three doors down. She jumps into her car and goes, okay, well, I'll pick you up then. And as promised, I go to church with her for the first time ever in my life. And at this point, I'm 46 years old. And I go to church and I'll never forget, you know, I walked in there on her arm. Literally, she's literally got me by the arm, walks me into the church. I'll never forget that first greeter, which is why greeting is such a big deal to me, I think, because I remember meeting my first church greeter that day. And I think his name was Antonio or Armero or Roberto. I don't remember, but it was the way he hugged me and the way he loved me in that moment. He was the most loving, kind spirit you could ever meet. And that was the first person I saw at the church who was not my best friend. That's why I think we put such a big emphasis on our greeters here. Like, that's a huge deal because you never know who's going to walk through your doors. You could have Christians who don't believe anymore. You could have Christians who've fallen away. You could have Christians who just need to reconnect. And you could have people who are there for the first time. And you know what they say, you have only one chance to make a first impression. So we try. Although I would say if it's
a great job.
But if it's renewed in God's plan, doesn't really matter. He'll make it happen. And I remember going to the church that day and I'm okay. Like I'm checking myself. I'm like, okay. Because I always thought I would be very uncomfortable in a church. And this is a non-denominational Protestant church. So everything looks very down to earth, right? There's no big symbols. There's no big anything. It's just like any other Protestant church. And I sit next to my best friend. And okay, we get through the worship music, which is fine. But again, if you're not a Christian yet, it's kind of weird. And then my pastor's wife gets on stage. And I'm thinking, oh, okay, Pastor Gary's not teaching. Okay, no problem. We can adjust. And I'll never forget it. Her name is Tammy. And Tammy gets up there, a woman, again, of great wisdom, strength, and love. This goes back to, don't worry so much about knowing every scripture, piece of scripture. It's who you are. It's being with him and being in that moment that actually, in my experience, is what impacts people more. So there she was, Mrs. Gary, just like him. That presence of eternal wisdom, love, and nurture. And she starts teaching on the Romans. And I'm like, okay. It's not too weird. This is the first time I'm ever hearing the New Testament. I'm like, okay, this is all right. Kind of get it, don't really get it, but I'm listening. And my friend, April, who's sitting to my right, have you ever taken a new person to church who's not a believer? You know how you are. You're always kind of checking. She's checking in on me like, how's she receiving this? Is she going to freak out and run out of here? You know, like, so she's just sitting there like, okay, hopefully things, you know. And then I remember Tammy finishing up the sermon and then placing big vase or a jug made out of glass or plastic on the teaching podium. And then she takes a big, I guess you could say, a pouring jar of water, and she begins to pour water into this vase that was previously empty. And she fills it up, pretty much fills it up. And she says, now there, I know some of you in the audience today think that your life's pretty good and your life is good. Whatever tragedies you had, you've overcome. You're pretty strong. You've made it this far. You're good. You don't really need God. You don't need really anything else. You have a pretty good life. And I'm like, and of course, right away, I'm thinking, oh, yeah, that's me. She's right. I'm pretty good. Don't need any other help. Thank you. And then she goes, but what if? And then she takes the rest of the pouring jar and pours the water into the vase, which was already full with water. And the water overflows the vase and it goes all over the teaching podium. This water flows all over the stage. And she does this whole, and she goes, but what if your life was, and I forgot to say, like, overflowing? What if your life could be incredible? So this was a very smart thing that she was teaching. Usually you teach like, look, if you're unhappy, so accept God, then maybe God will fill the hole in your life. This was a totally different teaching. This was a teaching of, for those of you who think you're good, you got this, and your life is pretty good already, what if your life could be incredible? And I never forgot that teaching. And I walked out of there and that got me to think. And I came back the next Sunday and the next Sunday, and Gary was back now teaching instead of his wife. And this is how they taught. They taught, expository. They would read very long paragraphs from the Bible and then would teach to it. And while this is, so I'm now all of a sudden, everything is making sense. Things are starting to click, right? When the timing is right, when you have the right teachers, and when your soul is ready, starting to get ready. So they're teaching now. So every Sunday, so this is goes on now for probably 2 to 3 months. And in the meantime, I begin to do my own research now. This is, again, me, the scientist.
Of course you did.
Right? It's not enough that some wonderful people are speaking to me. And again, notice all of the tools that are being used here, right? You have the teaching from the stage. You have the incredible Christian circle of friends who are living out the word by being who they were being rather than Bible thumping. You have teachers who are coming across to you as all loving, not completely non-judging, that their very presence in the way they deliver the word speaks to the fact that they will meet you where you're at and then there's no judgment. That was the environment in that church. And this, again, why we're so proud of our church, like why we're so kind of obsessed with the Holy Spirit, is because the Holy Spirit was alive in that church. There was no more than 700 people in that entire church, not a mega church, but not a little one. But what I remember is the way people loved each other in the church, the transparency, the complete lack of artificial nonsense. There was no facade because the pastor never carried any facades.
I love that.
The pastor would get on stage. I won't share some of the things he shared, but he shared things about his life that were very, very difficult and deeply private.
He was willing to take off the mask and be vulnerable and real and his, show you guys that he is a work in progress.
And his wife. And this is why this actually impacted very much the kind of faith that I always got attracted to, the kind of Christian people that I tended to be attracted to, is because I was led to Christ by leaders who led in humility and in complete nudity. It means like you knew everything about them. So because of that, nobody ever, there was no like, look at my car. You know, nobody, people openly, there would be what churches usually do, classroom, right? Classes afterwards. People would go to class and people would openly talk about, oh yeah, I have this addiction. Yes, I cheated on my wife twice. Or yeah, we had an affair, didn't work out. Yeah, I have a gay son. And people just ripped their clothes off like that because the environment was one of authenticity. So while all this is going on and I haven't accepted Christ yet, I continue to do my research. And now I get serious and my scientific brain gets attracted to Christian apologetics. This is when I came across Frank Turek, right, who's Charlie Kirk's best friend, who was there on that fateful day. His work is phenomenal. I get attracted to the McDowells, right, Sean McDowell, and many of these other great Christian thinkers who are using reason to show you, to teach you why actually faith is not the enemy of reason at all, that there is no conflict between reason and faith. And that was the approach that I needed. I come across a DVD series that gets launched called Christ Revealed. If you have not seen this, you guys, I don't care if you're a deep Christian that's deep in his walk, or if you're a new Christian, if you're considering about, if you have questions about the historicity of Christ and Christianity, whether Christ truly existed, what is the evidence for his existence? This is the series. It's about a 7-9-part series. Look it up, called Christ Revealed. And the man who produced it and hosts it is a physician, medical physician, atheist. Starts off as a total atheist. And this to him is just another revealed series. Turns out this man had done other revealed series, money revealed, pharma revealed, whatever. So to him, this was, why not pick up Christ too? We'll do some research. We'll go deep. And he goes deep into Christ, goes into Israel, goes outside of Israel, digs deep, looks up, does all of this great research. By the time he's done researching this for this series, he completely converts to Christianity. So here's another man of science who says, oh my God, this happened, and becomes a Christian. So Christ Revealed. So I see Christ Revealed, and this gets me even closer. At this point, things are moving very quickly. I continue to go to church. This all literally happens within like my first 4 months going to church. I continue to go to church. I continue to do my research. I continue to read near-death experiences, and I'm coming across more and more presence of God in these near-death experiences. I continue to research Christian apologetics and read Christian apologists. And one weekend, my husband goes away on a business trip. And my pastor goes away that weekend too on his own business trip. And I'm alone and no Pastor Gary and no husband. And I am alone in my house. And at this point, they've got me already. I begin to feel the pull towards God very strongly. And one of the things I clearly remember is, first, you need to decide, do you want him? Because once you want him, things become really easy. I think for the most part of my life, I fought him. I fought the desire to have him in my life. Because once I made the decision to want him, then all of a sudden, all the evidence in the world appeared. All of a sudden, the right teachers came in. All of a sudden, the right people showed up and said just the right things. I'm reading yet another News Ethics Experience book called My Descent into Death by Mr. Howard Storm. Those of you who haven't read it, especially if you're a skeptic or an unbeliever, I definitely advise you to read it. It's called My Descent into Death by Howard Storm, a great man. And I'm reading his book, and this is another atheist who God broke him during his near-death experience. And he came back in his 30s and resigned as the dean of the University of Kentucky Art School and became a pastor of a sweet little church in Ohio, Kentucky, but one of those. I think it's Ohio. Anyway, changed his whole life for Christ because he met him. And that was it. Anyway, I'm very moved by this book. But again, I relate to Howard very much because, again, educator, University of Kentucky Art School dean, completely well-educated man and whose heart God completely turns. And this was a final straw for me. And again, all of these factors, but this was the final factor. And I'm sitting by myself, I remember, in the house, and I have every door closed and I have every window closed. And I'm sitting at my kitchen bar and I'm reading. And I remember Howard says on a YouTube video, when he explains how he came to God, he said, listen, you know, guys, you don't need to. People think they have to make it so official, say the right thing to Jesus to bring him in, said, don't worry about it. Just say this. And he had language that he said, just say, Lord, basically, I know that I've lived without you all my life. And I thought I never needed you. And my life, frankly, if I have to be honest, kind of sucks without you. And he just uses basic English. I don't have this in front of me, but I'll share it if you like as a resource. But when Howard gave me those words, basically on YouTube, and said, this is what you can say if you're not sure how to talk to him. And I said them. And I actually later, I wrote them down from YouTube and I said them and I initialed them and I have the date on those words. And I remember the moment I said them immediately. So physically what happened, I felt like a huge, like a very strong wind, like a gust of wind, a very located, like very specifically located gust of wind, not like a little breeze and not like very strong wind just go right through me. And again, remember, all the doors and windows are closed. There's no breeze in the house. There's no source for a wind. There's no source for a breeze, let alone a wind. So this thing goes through me and pushes me back on my chair. And I literally go like this. And I turn around to look behind me to first reactions of who's there. But I remember very clearly that feeling of that. It's as if, and I remember told later my husband, it's as if he was standing there.
Oh, I believe it.
All along.
I had that in sixth grade, an encounter with wind and God's presence. So 100%
the wind.
Believe it. Yes,
and
there's
the
something
wind
about
is
it.
So strong. That's what was remarkable is I remember thinking, this is really very, this is something very strong. And I just started to cry. And I just cried by myself. And I just sat there crying and crying and crying. But I remember feeling from that moment on, I never felt alone again. And I remember even now, all I have to do is just stop and focus on him and he's there. It's just sometimes, you know, as you go through your days and you're involved in your everyday activities and you're tasking, right? You're not Mary,
Martha.
Martha. You're Martha. You're Martha-ing throughout your day. Even in my most busy moments, I can always stop and go, you know what, Lord, stop. I just got to stop. And then the minute I stop and I literally pay attention, all of a sudden you're wired in.
So after that encounter with mm-hmm. the Lord's presence, would you say that you were all in? Something shifted from that moment
that's
on?
It.
That was
that's
it?
That's it. And that's it. I've been a Christian ever since. And that was the beginning of my Christian journey. And it is a journey for sure. You can imagine, right? You still have your old patterns. And no question that Christ broke through a lot of chains. But there are still chains that the surrender, you have to surrender. I do anyway. I have to practice surrender every single day. To this day, my initial responses are often self-centered. And thank God, again, I have an incredible husband who has often been like, whoa, whose spirit is that in? Is that in God's spirit right now? You're acting this way? Or he'd be like, who are you thinking about right now? Is that really what he wants? like constantly jarring me to connect back to the source, connect back to him. When I connect to him, I can't describe it. All I can say is it's an understatement that he has made me a much better human being. Like he turned my whole world upside down. And I remember showing up at church the following Sunday. And at this point, nobody but my husband knows I've accepted Christ because my pastor was gone. Pastor's back now. And he does his usual, what's it called? The call.
Altar call.
He does his usual altar call, which he does at the end of it. And he goes, there's anybody here who would like to accept our Lord Jesus Christ? Please raise your hand. And I rose my hand and he just looks at me. And again, he's been there for the last 4 months, knows the battle, knows my personality and knows what I was battling against intellectually, battling against myself. And he goes, feel free to come to the front. I'll never forget it. He actually stops. He goes, I'm sorry, I have to stop. There's somebody here who just accepted Christ that I can't believe. Like he didn't say, I can't believe it, but he just said, I'm sorry, this is very big. And at this point, I had some of my other Christian friends with me and they're like glowing. I've never seen people so happy. And my baptism was amazing. He's the one who baptized me. I had 20 people at my baptism, all the Christians who fought for me. And it turned out many of my so-called Christian friends that were in my circle for 20 years. And remember I said they never thumped their Bible. They just lived it. Turned out, I didn't know this, they were praying for me every single day for 20 years. They prayed that I would find. And I called a couple of my other friends who were like distant Christians, means physically, geographically, but who had fought in their own way for me, who were there for me, who did try to get me to the Lord more proactively. And I was mean to them. I pushed them away. I disrespected them. And one of them now is my best friends. And I called my friend Nance, who's one of those Christians who did fight for me very hard over the years. And I remember I said, Nance, I have something I want to tell you. And there's like complete silence on the other line. And she, out of nowhere, and again, remember, I didn't talk to her a lot. Out of nowhere, she says, you're a believer. And I said, that's right. How did you know? She goes, I know.
I've been praying for
you.
Yeah,
she was one of my biggest fighters. And it's been incredible. And
it's incredible that you didn't even know that they were praying for you all those years until after.
Right, because they had to. They knew my personality. They knew they couldn't take me on directly.
So for everyone listening, don't stop praying.
Don't
keep praying for your friends, for your loved ones, for your spouse.
20 years, someone.
God hears. My mom's been praying for my dad for 40.
Oh.
Around 40.
But when the timing is right, it is right. My pastor, Pastor Gary, used to always say to me, because he used to say to us, because we'd be like, you know, we chose our faith. And he'd be like, oh, you think you chose him? Interesting. In other words, like when he chooses. But you have to choose him back.
We have to want a relationship with him.
So the only thing I want to say is to people who are maybe not coming more from my background, not coming from the Christian families, not raised in the church, is it's okay. Like if you're questioning, if you are skeptical, it's okay. It's where you are now. It's okay. There's nothing wrong with where you are now. It doesn't matter really how you find him, as long as you can find him.
What would you tell to your 20-year-old self, if someone's listening?
I would have told myself and want to tell to young people in general is, I know you think us older people are crazy and we're out of touch, but pay attention and listen. That's all I can say. Just listen. Listen. He's there. He's there in the voices of those around you. Sometimes he's there in the events that are happening around you. Sometimes it's good to be quiet and just to listen and you will hear him.
He does. He speaks in the quiet and the stillness.
Yes.
Actually, now that I think about it, I don't know if I've ever heard him in the busyness and music playing and chatter going. I've had to remove myself from that and quiet myself in a bedroom by myself and be in the silence.
Yes.
And obviously he speaks to us through his word. And he will never, ever tell us anything that contradicts his word.
Right.
But yes, he does speak in the stillness.
So that's why that was important for me to tell, because I know there's even people in our church who go to church and they want to believe and they kind of do believe, but they're still questioning. I know who some of them are. So I wanted to say to them, it's okay to question. Don't be afraid to question. Don't be ashamed of your questions. You have a mind, you have a brain. Hey, the good news is God answers all those questions. Just be open. And like I said, no matter how you come to him, it's okay. The key is that you come.
He does say, when you seek me with all of your heart. I think sometimes people will search for him, but it's not like a desperation where you want him and you can't live without him. Like you're in a dry and a thirsty land and you're so thirsty. You got to be that desiring of him. And he said he'll reveal himself and he'll make himself.
He always will. And he's always there. And you just have to open your eyes and open your ears. And the other thing I remember you'd asked me before, what would you say to a non-believer? And I would say the one thing right now is just to let it go. I know that right now you are carrying a big burden. I know you are. I don't care how well you think your life is going. You are carrying a burden. Your mind doesn't stop going. What the next task, the next problem you need to solve. Just, it's okay, man. Like, let it go. Because it's all been taken care of. Existentially, actually, there's really no problem already. The problem's been already solved. So you just do the best you can. That's all you can do. You do the walk the best that you can walk. But when you're with him, you know what peace really is. Because you know who's really in charge. And it ain't you. So let it go, guys.
Let it go.
Let it go.
And if anybody has any questions, they can relate to you. If they have something they would like to ask you, can you give out your email?
Yes, of course. It's HelenMBloom@mac.com. And that's spelled Helen with one L, M as in Mary, Bloom, BLOOM, @mac.com. And I'm also happy to recommend resources. So again, especially, and really anybody who wants to strengthen and gird their faith, if you are not a believer yet or you are a new believer, I'm happy to recommend all of the wonderful resources and references and all the people whose writings and arguments really helped get me closer and closer to God. And they can do the same thing for you. And again, at the end of the day, you do have to take a leap of faith, but it doesn't have to be as big of a leap as you think.
Mm-hmm.
So
thank you so much, Helen. I sure do appreciate you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Remember, when life feels out of focus, there is always one who brings clarity. We'll see you next time.